Welcome to the Conference on World Affairs. Today is Friday, April 12th. It is 3 o'clock p.m., and this is panel number 4505, You In or You Out. I am the moderator. My name is Connor Seil. I'm the director of research for One Earth Future, which is an operating foundation based here in Colorado that works on issues of global governance and security. You may not know this, but next year marks the 75th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. Since the founding of the United Nations, there has been a host of other international organizations that have sprung up, creating a global multilateralist order. At the same time, two stories have developed over the past 75 years, both of which I would argue have some truth to them. One story says that the UN has materially succeeded at what it set out to do, which was eliminating great power war. But more than that, the 75 years of the UN's existence have been some of the best 75 years in the history of humanity for peace, for education, for human security, and human development. This story would say that the political science research shows that UN peacekeeping mostly worked, the UN Millennium Development Goals mostly worked, and that the UN as a whole mostly worked. On the other hand, the competing story points out that the UN has manifestly failed to act in the face of severe human rights abuses and mass atrocities in Syria and Libya and elsewhere, that the Security Council is, by design, incapable of making decisions on hard or complex structures, and that the UN is inefficient, overly bureaucratic, and expensive. It also points out that the UN takes democratic sovereignty and pushes it towards unelected technocrats in New York, or depending on which institution you're talking about, in Brussels or Addis Ababa. Over the last 5 years, that second point has become a flashpoint internationally, with populist movements all over the world developing around the idea of reclaiming sovereignty from these institutions. So it's in that context, this age of Bolton and Bolsonaro and Brexit, that this panel asks the question, are you in or are you out? What is the future of the international order? This is a roundtable, not a traditional panel, and so most of the conversation is going to be, as much as possible, a discussion among the panelists. I will be taking questions from the audience using the CWA app or the more traditional approach, pencil and paper. If you would like to pose a question, you can either use the app or you can raise your hand, and a volunteer will provide you with a piece of paper and a pencil to address it. We have five distinguished panelists here today. I'm going to very briefly give them introductions because the full bios are available in your program. They are, starting to my left, Nancy Donaldson, the former director of the Washington Office of the International Labor Organization, Susie Snyder, the president of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Margot Squire, a former Foreign Service officer with the U.S. Information Agency and the State Department, Alexander Verbeek, founder for the Institute for Planetary Security, and Ambassador Ross Wilson, interim chargé d'affaires de Georgia and former ambassador to Turkey and Azerbaijan. So, to the panel, the first question, and I'd invite you to respond just for this first question, one at a time, and then we'll jump into the discussion, is, are you in or are you out? Is the international system in its current form better than any other alternative, or do we need to chuck it and start over?
Okay, let me introduce myself a little more. The ILO, the International Labor Organization, is a specialized UN agency. So I'm one of the people up here who's from the UN, accused of all those things. And I just want to mention this morning I went to the artificial intelligence panel, and Alexander Bard told us that the future is very few jobs, we're going to become more and more tribal, and we're going to learn from YouTube how to make bombs, and then we're going to send bombs at each other with drones. So just to mention, you mentioned the past, let me mention the future, and he's a futurist, and say that I think our only peaceful future is going to be involved in multilateral institutions, including the UN, peacekeeping institutions, and they need to get better, and they need to be reformed. And I don't know if we have more than 1 minute or not, so you want me to stop there?
Well,
I'll do the one other thing I wanted to say. So what's going on in the world today that the UN's working on? I just want to read you a little list, so you can think about whether you'd rather the United States works on these things, or who else. So today, Libya is about to fall apart into another big war, and the UN chief is calling for a halt to the escalation. The UN has warned that health sites lack water, and that could create a superbug pandemic around the world. The UN Habitat is pitching floating cities in face of climate change. That's interesting. A UN chief has been named a leader for a Myanmar investigation because of the human rights violations on the Rohingya. The an expert representing the UN is now going to probe the Ecuadorian complaints against Julian Assange. Australia has discontinued any payments to the UN Climate Fund. And the FAO is warning that the desertification in Arab states, the growing desert, is reaching emergency levels. The FAO is saying the African countries most affected by acute hunger are heading into further conflict and violence. These are some of the things on the plate of the UN today.
Okay, well, that puts it over to me. Thank you very much, Nancy. Hi, everybody. I'm Susie. I think it's a great question to ask. You know, as you come up to an anniversary of any time, it's a good opportunity to take stock. Are we doing what we said we wanted to do? And if not, why not? And so coming back to that initial vision set out 75 years ago to abolish the scourge of war, well, there's been wars, and there have not been wars. How do we prove negatives, right? It's a big question, a lot. To increase the opportunity and access to human rights for all persons, having equal access to all human rights. I think we're, as a global society, I think our definition, our understanding of how this applies to all persons has changed since 1945 significantly, right? All persons doesn't mean only white men anymore. All persons means all persons, and that's pretty cool. And I think this is growing. So, you know, I lean towards a good thing there. And restorative justice. If you recall, in the 1940s, there was this push to kind of end a colonial period. And how do you help countries transition out of colonialism? And this is a job I think the UN helped facilitate in some places somewhat okay. But it's not one of the kind of three core areas of the UN's work any longer. And I wonder if that's good or if that's bad. And I tend to think it could be quite useful, because I think there are still repercussions that our society is facing because of a history of colonialism. And if you look at that, you can see it here in the United States. You can see it throughout the world. But the question is, we built the UN, and we can change the UN. Could we build a global order that involves 193 countries as equal participants, everyone, at least on paper, having the same access, the same opportunity, 193 governments. Could we do that today? I don't know.
I feel very short here. So to answer the basic questions, yes, I'm in. We need the UN. It is still absolutely relevant. In fact, even more relevant as we heard, the issues are getting more complex. We can't solve them on our own. Does it need reform? Yes, of course. But at least we don't need to blow up an organization to make it better. And I wanted to share a personal story. In 2008, I was directing an organization within the Foreign Service Institute, which is the State Department's in-house training organization. And we had kind of a unique organization that was like a think tank within the Foreign Service Institute, that we could bring people together across different parts of government as well as the State Department to look at certain issues. And the issue that in December of 2008, the International Organizations Office of the State Department wanted to look at was, how do we get more involved with the UN? Because this was the end of the Bush administration, transition to Obama. And the Obama administration came in saying, we need to build alliances. We need to develop these multilateral approaches. So over the course of 3 days, with government people, outside government people, civil society groups, people who were working on various issues at the UN, working with the UN and had strong concerns, we looked at, you know, what are some of the low-hanging fruit, and you know, what were some of the ways that the new administration could get in and actually make a signal that the U.S. wanted to be a leader again in the global community, and so found a number of these places, low-hanging fruit right away that we could get involved in, rejoining UNESCO, joining the UN Human Rights Commission, which the Bush administration had refused, and also they pulled out of UNESCO. There were a number of things, but right off the bat, by doing this, the Obama administration did. It retook sort of the global leadership, and I think that that's what the U.S. should be thinking about and as we go forward and look at reforming these institutions, the vested interest that we have in them.
In a panel like this, you would like to have somebody that is on the outside, because we just had a few invoices. Have to disappoint you. I'm in as well. I'm a diplomat. Diplomats believe, most of them, not sure what Ross is going to say, diplomats believe firmly in multilateralism. When we founded the United Nations in just on the ruins of the Second World War, we had just had half a century where we massively have been murdering each other. Second World War, what is it? Something like 50 million people murdered. First World War, the endless, useless slaughter of people. That was the first half of the 20th century. We tried it with the League of Nations, but we never ever had a moment that the major countries in the world were all at the same time a member of the League of Nations. And then look at the second half of the 20th century. The number of people that died in warfare rapidly went down, and all kinds of other progress that we made. Look at, for instance, children dying in the first 5 years of their lives. When I was born in 65, there was still 18%. It's now down to 4%. What an amazing progress. Look at what we achieved with education and think about fighting poverty and hunger. We're now in the next 20 years, we expect another few billions of people that are lifted out of poverty and are going to live the kind of lives that we live. Those are amazing numbers, and the fact that we had a multilateral system with all its flaws, and it, of course it's going slowly, and yes, you have these diplomats at their cocktail receptions where people are complaining about, we did actually achieve a lot. And it is not easy. It's so much more easy to look at the things that went wrong. I firmly believe that the challenges that we are facing now are more than ever, much more than in the past 75 years. We need multilateralism, because more than 75 years ago, the problems that we are facing have globalized. And if you have globalized problems, think about climate change, for instance. You need a global approach. You can't solve these problems as a single nation because of the very simple rule of the tragedy of the commons. Everybody says that somebody else should start. And you don't get there that way. So the only way you get there is if you all come together and work on it. Well, is this the only solution? Should we go on like it is? Well, of course, a system that was founded 75 years ago is getting a bit outdated. Why are there, speaking as a European, I mean, I'm happy that we have two of the five permanent members of the Security Council, those five countries that have the right for a veto. Why are two of them from Europe? Look at the map of the world, you know, we're tiny. We have two votes. Where is Brazil or India or some other major countries? South Africa could be a good one. So, of course, that is not fair. If we would do a zero-based budgeting exercise, nobody would design it this way, except maybe for those five countries who would like it that way, right? So, yes, we need reform. But we definitely need multilateralism as well as all kinds of other forms of cooperation. We might touch on that later. I don't want to speak too long, but you can think on other ways of cooperating, other actors, other stakeholders that are coming together to tackle these changes. But it doesn't mean abolishing of the multilateral system as we have it.
Well, good afternoon. One thing I should say, I think I can do this on behalf of the entire group, is how honored we all are to be part of this Conference on World Affairs. We congratulate the organizers and especially congratulate all of you for having the opportunity to be part of discussions about so many different interesting topics, eclectic, not just international affairs, but all the other aspects that make this such a different and a terrific conference. When you come last, it's a little bit easier. A lot of what I would have said has been said. I'll make, I think, 3 points. First, underlying the issue that was put on the table here, I think, are a couple of questions. Is the architecture of the international system permanent? Should it be permanent? Should we not ask questions about whether the institutions that we've created continue to make sense? And if not, you know, should they be changed? Should they be abolished? Should they be replaced by something else? And I think, as a sidebar from that, the mere fact that we're having this conversation here and the topic is presented the way it was is a reflection of the fact that a lot of Americans question whether these organizations actually serve our interests and do a good job. And I think it's a task for policymakers, it's a task for those involved with these agencies, for those who are interested in believing in what they do, to make that case to the American people and help explain how and why this is important. Second, to pick up on the initial comments that Nancy made, there are a whole range of specialized agencies and activities here that most Americans know relatively little about that do a lot of work that no one else does or no one else pulls together and organizes and sort of deconflicts what different international players and actors are doing. Among those that I know the best, UN High Commission for Refugees, helping to support a refugee population that now is around 60 million people around the world, including, I think, around 11 million refugees, IDPs from Syria alone. Nobody else can play the role in catalyzing the resources necessary to support this desperately needed community, and also provide other resources of its own. Similarly, World Health Organization, World Food Organization, UN Development Program that plays roles on development in the third world that none of the rest of us that can play for a variety of reasons. In Georgia, where I presently serve, the assistance programs that we provide in territory that's occupied by Russia in a portion of the territory of Georgia goes through UNDP because we can't go there. It's occupied by Russia. Mm-hmm. An absolutely essential role. We could be less enthusiastic about the UN General Assembly and maybe less enthusiastic to some extent about the Security Council. Wasteful, maybe a talk shop, maybe in some respects dysfunctional. And there, you know, my conclusion isn't so much who in, who out, or it's how fixed. And Alex has referred to some of that, and I think we can come back to that in the discussion. Third point I'd make on the really big issues of defense and security, the UN is not the big issues, the big global issues of defense and security, not the local conflicts. The UN is not a disembodied entity. It's the countries that make it up. And to the extent that the UN is failing, it's failing because the countries that dominate the defense and security landscape either don't want it to succeed or don't make use of that instrument for one reason or another, and it ends up being kind of wrong to blame it on the UN.
great. And because this is a roundtable, from this point on, what I'd encourage is for panelists to jump in to respond to anything that you just heard that you want to pick up on, and to have a conversation as much with each other as with the audience. I do have questions. I will be dropping them in as needed. But first, I want to just pitch it back to the panel to see if anybody has anything that they want to pick up on.
I have stuff. I have stuff. Can I say stuff? Good. No, this is great. I think it's interesting that we do all kind of come at this from a similar perspective. We do like the multilateral scene. We think it's kind of great. It's an interesting way to organize society. But I stuff at it, and the thing that jumped into my mind is, instead of this question of you in or you out, is should we ask the question, do we veto the veto? You know, that's another kind of framing. The Security Council, where five countries, because of where they were positioned, once a long while ago, probably before most of the people in this room were born, where they were positioned, they have this veto power. And it comes into the question of what is the projection of power, which is another thing I'm curious as to how other panelists here think about this. And in the UN system, from my perspective, not as a diplomat, but as an NGO person who, because of what color my name tag is, I can go into some conference rooms, but not all. And that's how it works in those halls. But I see a lot of projections of power, and both in the system as it exists, as well as kind of the way the system is trying to, the multilateral system is trying to deal with that. And one is this question of the use of force and violence and the projection of power through force. Right, and I think this came up a little bit in what Ross had said. I think it came up a little bit in what Margo had said. And when you use force or violence to project your power. Another thing is all about the Benjamins, right? It's the economy, stupid. Sorry, bad jokes. But it's the projection of power through economic interests. And where does the UN have opportunities to play into this? Because we heard a couple of things. We heard how we can funnel money to development through some UN agencies and help in some ways that way. But where are the oversight questions on investment from one country into the critical infrastructure of another country? For example, if I might want to build some great roads and airports in my country, who might pay for it? China might. What kind of relationship does that build? If I have debt as a national, I have a national debt and I need somebody to finance my debt or refinance my debt, who's going to pay for it? Another question, and that projection of power through economic strength. And the last thing is where does the UN come in? And again, this is slightly touched on, but it's around this projection of power through information, through control of information, through winning hearts and minds. And if there's a feeling globally that there is, that the UN is a talk shop, I think personally that talking is way better than fighting. I would much rather fight you with my words than with my fists, or my bombs, or airplanes, or so on. But in that projection of power through information and information warfare and control of information, where and how does the UN fit in? And maybe we're missing, we haven't talked about the public-private partnerships as much. Alexander mentioned it briefly, but when Microsoft launches a digital peace platform, in order to say the global institutions are not doing enough to protect the cyber for cybersecurity, so we as Microsoft are going to do something digitally to project peace in the world. How does that tie into what governments are doing? Because those conversations are not very transparent. But again, I might not have had the right color name badge to get into that room. Those are my first thoughts.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the question, a second shot at your first question. So, in fact, in recent times, there have been new structures that have been created. And I'm going to just give you two quick examples, and they're good ones and they're solid. And one is the UNAIDS, which was created by the realm of all the UN agencies that had some role in dealing with health. And that entity, in cooperation with some critical countries and organizations, really successfully initiated a global effort to tackle the AIDS epidemic. And worked with countries, and some countries didn't want to admit they had problems, and others were accusing others. And it's an example where UN agencies together worked on a very specific program by creating a structure out of the UN. And people look at that as something to think about when we may have something larger than even a UN structure. The second one is one that I was very involved in for the last 10 years, which is the G20. So when the global recession hit, and we were really in a major crisis globally with the economy, the IMF, which was an institution about global economic stability, had one client. The world hated them so much because they work on restructuring debt and restructuring economies. They only had one client at that time. It was Turkey. And when the Great Recession hit, not only did the heads of state raise the level of a finance minister meeting to the heads of state meeting around what do we do about this crisis, but they also decided together to recapitalize the IMF and use it as a tool and an instrument of the G20, which was not out of the UN. G20 is the largest 20 economies of the world, by the way. Europe has one seat. The U.S. has a seat, and so forth. And in that process, just to say things can happen and reform does happen, the countries that came forward from those economies, large economies like Brazil and South Africa and other countries that haven't been in the Security Council, said we need to reform the voting representation in the IMF. Because it's a different time, and the countries who are these economies need to be at that table. And they decided to reform who was going to be represented there as a part of that process. And it took a while. It took until the very end of the Obama administration to actually get the U.S. to support that reform and voting strength. But it was a very important thing because the investment of the countries in the world to work on these issues together required authoritative participation. And it revitalized and forced, instead of having a secretariat, they used institutions of the UN. So the ILO, my institution, which has worked on the jobs crisis, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, it forced all our institutions that often work in silos to all work together, and the UN, to work on how do you solve these problems. And that's been an incredibly interesting process. Not perfect, not solving everything, but it was a lot of dialogue and a lot of negotiation about managing, righting the monetary situation in the world and stopping the bleeding that the recession caused. So I just want to say we're not talking pie in the sky. These are things that have happened recent in historical times that are very important.
So yeah, Margo has a response and then I'll bring in some questions.
Well, I wanted to talk about, there was a reference to this question about how expensive the UN is and the fact, you know, are we getting, you know, enough from what we're putting into it. And so the UN finances, there are different mechanisms. There's a basic amount that each country is supposed to put in, and it's based on the strength of your economy. So the U.S. contributes the largest portion because we have the largest economy. And the second point is that we also, there are voluntary funds, and the U.S. traditionally has been a huge contributor to the voluntary funds. And these funds do things like what Ross was talking about. They're for disaster relief, for humanitarian assistance, for famine and things around the world that you need to settle at the spot on the ground where they're happening. And because they go through the UN, and this is the other point that I would make that we have not discussed, it's not the United States going into these countries. The UN provides this sort of a cover organization that is also acceptable to a lot of these other countries that don't want the U.S. necessarily involved. It also means that we can work in a bigger context that other countries will work together with us because it's under the UN umbrella, even if it's very thin. We were talking about anti-piracy earlier, for example.
So we're getting some really exciting questions. For those of you who are submitting questions, I apologize in advance if we don't get to them. I will try to identify underlying themes. One of the great things about CWA is that it's an opportunity for the students to see you bold and interact, and so we prioritize student questions. I've got two student questions that I think make for a really interesting pair with each other. One student asked, why won't the UN recognize Abkhazia, Somaliland, Artsakh, South Ossetia, Western Sahara? Isn't respecting self-determination a goal of the UN? And another student asked, I think, a question that fits really neatly with that, which is, when should the UN overrule national-level decisions and why? And if never, why not? So I pitched these two questions as a pair to the panel.
I'll take a step. Why won't the UN recognize breakaway entities? The UN actually doesn't recognize any breakaway entities. Members vote to allow countries to become members. Members also vote to allow entities to have observer status. The UN itself, again, it's not a disembodied entity. It's a function of the 100 decisions that the 190 members make, on especially on these kinds of things. And the UN hadn't, the UN doesn't do this. It does not recognize these kind of, in virtually no case does it do it. Self-determination clearly recognized in the UN system as an important principle, so is territorial integrity. In other words, the idea that the right to self-determination is not an unlimited one, and it's not something that just takes place in an otherwise neutral atmosphere. Countries recognize each other's boundaries, they respect each other's boundaries, and the general principle is changes in international boundaries are okay if they're consensual. So to the extent that Abkhazia, someone referred to that, breakaway region of Georgia that's occupied by Russia, which in turn arranged for Abkhazia to declare itself an independent state and to arrange for some countries, I think 6 or 7, to recognize it as an independent state. The international practice is we all recognize, the UN recognized Georgia in its territorial integrity at the time it was admitted. Russia repeatedly recognized Georgia's territorial integrity for years and years and years until going to war with Georgia over these territories in 2008. And you don't just get to change these things because you decided. You change things because people agree. And anyway, harmonizing those two pieces, territorial integrity and self-determination, it's one of the toughest pieces in international affairs. It was a particularly difficult challenge in the former Yugoslavia, but in a variety of other places, and the way it's worked has been mutual agreement. Should the UN overrule national decisions? The UN is made up of sovereign governments. Sovereignty means something. It means you make your own decisions. And I think basically outside the context of mandatory UN Security Council resolutions, there's a specific provision in the UN Charter, the UN doesn't make mandatory judgments or establish mandatory requirements that countries must meet. That's part of our system of sovereign states. Nobody decided to undo that in 1945, and no one's decided to undo that since.
I might want to add a minute on here, because I think it's important to build on what Ross is saying. It is about discussions, and it is about figuring this out through negotiations, right? So it's not me standing here and saying, I plant the Susie Snyder flag. You all must recognize me as my independent sovereign nation. It is saying, okay, hey, Margo, I want to be my own country. How about we be neighbors? And then going. And I think it's important to really look at it at that very clear level. But it doesn't happen all at once. And in some situations, with some multilateral institutions, it still hasn't fully happened. And this is where you find in documents asterisks. That, for example, say one country only recognizes this other country by a particular name. And it happens in deciding the rules of procedure around how is this conference, how is this discussion going to take place. And if you're setting up a new kind of negotiation, part of that is negotiating how you negotiate. Right, it's like the meeting before the meeting to figure out how the meeting's going to go, which happens. And so in setting up those rules of procedure, that is where some decisions can get made. So when we did the negotiation on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the decision in negotiating the rules of procedure was to recognize and grant the Holy See status as equal status to other member states, whereas the Holy See is often considered an observer state. And it gave them a different type of voice. Same thing with the state of Palestine. Gave a different type of voice. And so there are these different mechanisms. And then when you start building up more and more and more recognition, it kind of comes back to the UN. So I just wanted to break that down just a little bit more, because it's a really tough question. And Ross is right, this is the hardest thing, and it's the hardest thing to figure out how do we empower self-determination and yet still maintain a positive dialogue and not go down to, well, Margot's only going to recognize me if I beat up Margot, right? That's because we don't want to devolve to that. We want to get away from that.
At least
on Margot. At least on Margot, right? It was very kind and very nice. I'm sorry to use that.
So, two items. One is that there's a couple of things that, or a couple of questions that have suggested that we also talk about NATO, the WTO, the other international institutions, and also a reminder that maybe not everybody's familiar with these institutions, what their specific role is. And so I encourage us to think more broadly, and then also to make sure when talking about these institutions that we say, hey, everybody, this is what they do. But there's also a question here that I think is an interesting challenge to the panel, which is pointing out that everyone here is more or less in agreement that these institutions are useful for the world, for the U.S., for the issues that we focus on. And so the question is, why not? There is a voice that says the U.S. specifically should withdraw from these institutions. The country of Britain has just, or the United Kingdom has just decided to withdraw from the EU. So why is it that the panel is not taking that stance? Why does the panel as a whole agree that we should be integrated?
Okay, I'm going to now, Connor, I'm going to actually ask this room to show hands, because I'm curious. And you can put your hand up or not if you like, but I'd just like to get a sense. Do you think the UN is a good idea?
Yeah.
Okay, I would say that almost, I would say 98%, 96% of this room.
Ask the other question.
Yes. Do you think the UN is a bad idea? Okay. Good. So it's good that some. Thank you very much for having courage to put your hand up. But the thing is, one person put their hand up. So generally, the question of this idea that people are saying the UN is a bad idea, the U.S. should withdraw from the UN, who is saying that? Right? Is it Donald Trump or is it John Bolton? Okay. Right? Or is it the right wing? But is it, and where is that discussion taking place? And I think that it's really important. One of the things I mentioned earlier is the power of information. And how is information being manipulated towards decision making and to projections of power? And this is something that the various specialized institutions within the UN are starting to figure out. This is something that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is starting to deal with, cyber challenges, but not so much on information warfare, not so much on controlling hearts and minds, unless they're in a country doing an out-of-area operations and dropping leaflets. Or, as sometimes has happened in the past, dropping leaflets and also dropping cluster bombs that may or may not have looked the same. But luckily, we've banned cluster bombs, so that's not going to happen again.
Alexander, what do you think?
Well, I disagree with two people in the back of the room, and I agree with everybody else. So I'm unusually quiet. Maybe my voice has been in quite a few panels already. I think if you look at the bigger context, we see worldwide a kind of new divide established that you could, in the past, you could say in politics you have like left and right. And I think it was The Economist that wrote a couple of years ago, some 3 years ago, they said, well, there's now a kind of new divide, and they called it open and closed. Open, and I suppose most of you in the room would consider yourself being part of open, is that you're open for new ideas, you're open for diversity, you're open for innovation, you're open in recognizing the difficulties that other countries or other people have, you're open in your international outlook. But we see a rise of closed, which is, if it occurs in the Netherlands, where you might have heard that rest of my accent, where I come from, we have the xenophobes on the right saying things like all the Muslims should leave the country, etc. But also, if you look at the extreme left, you see that they are also very nationalistic. So sometimes people call it the horseshoe. So it's not like a spectrum from left to right. But on the extremist side, they find each other, something like, you know, the Netherlands should go first. And it's the kind of movements you see everywhere in Europe, they're never really in a majority. It's normally anywhere between 10 and 20%, and it's much more on the extreme right than on the extreme left. But what you see happening in the UK is interesting. The absolute chaos that has broken out in a country that only a few centuries ago was ruling the world, a country that only 80 years ago stood alone in its fight against totalitarian regimes, very bravely, only that one single island. Nobody was helping them at that moment. Just one leader, Winston Churchill, saying, "We are not giving up. We don't have any weapons. We only have the blood and the tears, and we'll fight on the beaches," and every other of the beautiful words that he said. And he inspired the nation to keep fighting for the right thing. And later, of course, joined by the US and Canada and other allies. By the way, another ally was Soviet Union. They defeated fascism. And that is a really open kind of outlook. Look at where the UK is now. On completely fake assumptions and lies, the population has been manipulated into believing that they would get 350 million every week to pay for healthcare if they would leave the EU. And it is just unbelievable that half of the country falls for such a kind of lie. And now you see the same, this kind of open and close debate. Why is it so difficult in the UK? Because it splits through the parties. It's not just that Conservatives want Brexit. A lot of supporters of Labour also want it. So it is this, a typical example of this left-right and open and closed. And then we have the US. You're a special case, right? Gosh. It was here in San Francisco that for the first time, seriously, the countries of the world came together on what to do after the Second World War and to establish the United Nations. It is, the headquarters is in the U.S. The U.S. has played a leading role all over the world on so many cases, also in multilateralism. Look at those amazing few months at the end of 2015 when we agreed on a worldwide set of goals that we were going to make in the next 15 years, which are the Sustainable Development Goals. 17 goals, if we tick all those boxes, then the world will really be a better place. We would never get there without the support of the U.S. government. We would never have reached the very first really working international agreement on climate change without John Kerry and without Obama. And look where we are now. Which is the first country and only country to jump out of this agreement that is going to help us to save the planet? It is the U.S. What are you guys doing? I know it's not you in the room. So there's quite a challenge here. And then bring it back to multilateral institutions and the future of it. Of course it's not perfect. Of course there are ways where we have to improve it. But we are never going to solve these problems that are so urgent and so important on a scale as we've never ever seen before in mankind without multilateralism.
And I have one more question for them. pause for acknowledgement. And then I have one more question for the table, and then I'm going to ask everyone to give one final concluding remarks in response to what I think is one of the central questions that's been asked a couple of times. But the question for the table is, several people have asked some variant of the question of, but how do we improve the current international system? How do we improve the UN, NATO, the WTO, or the system as a whole? And in particular, several questions have focused on how do we improve the ability of international institutions to name and stop human rights violations. So I pitched that question to the table.
Well, I should probably start. Okay. So the ILO is an organization that was created 100 years ago in the Versailles Treaty. Okay. The organization that I work for, the International Labor Organization, was created by the Versailles Treaty, actually right after World War I, as an instrument of peace to help reconstruction. And it brought all the economic partners, labor, business, and government together to negotiate and work on how they were going to do that, and also to set standards in the workplace. But it was founded on the idea, and continues for 100 years, that economic justice, economic and social justice, are going to have to be part of the equation, or we're not going to have peace. And so our institution has cases filed by countries, by business, by labor, around human rights violations, particularly in the workplace. Freedom of association, freedom to collectively bargain, freedom from slavery, from child labor, the fundamental core labor standards. There are cases going on all the time, and more than 50% of the cases are around freedom of association, freedom of speech. And so there are venues, and it's not the only one, but this has been going on for 100 years, and we're not a law enforcement agency, but we use transparency and the condemnation of governments when of the community of nations when there's unacceptable human rights violations going on, and they have been some countries have been kicked out for periods of time because of that.
This is an open question for the table, although I'll admit I got my time management wrong. We go until 4:10, so we have more time. There will be a couple of more questions before the final responses.
It's a good question on how do you fix something, and I think identifying the problems, and this we've heard some good things here, and I want to say, you know, we've heard some good suggestions, and I think looking at how to do public-private partnerships, I think it's something that's really going to help all of these systems, and it's starting, and I think it's been starting since the Millennium Development Goals as a way to, Millennium Development Goals are like, okay, it's turning 2000, we got 10 years to tackle some of the big issues. Here's a plan. And got through, of course, not everything got fixed, but got through quite a bit, and a lot of it was really building up and ramping up these partnerships through the public-private partnerships. And I think that's something that can pick up. And the only other thing I'll throw out is to ask Amy, that was my note, how do politicians view this at all levels? View our relationship with international institutions and ask Amy because Amy Klobuchar is going to be here on tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I was like, oh, ask Amy. Everybody send her a question. What do you think of the UN? And she'll answer. Right? So, but to ask politicians at all levels about this connection, because even local communities can be connected to the UN and connected to international other communities around the world through sister cities and things like that, to really find ways to also bring these global challenges to the room and to help one another, and that will also start shifting the propaganda war.
I'll offer a couple of thoughts on these two questions on improvements. I'm not a great specialist in the United Nations, but a couple of ideas that are clearly out there. One is UN Security Council reform. I was involved in an effort in the mid-1990s in the Clinton administration to try to develop a consensus around what at the time seemed rather ambitious, expanding the council and bringing in additional permanent members. If I remember, it was India and Brazil, and maybe there was a third, who wouldn't have the veto because that was just too complicated. But through bringing in these major players on a more or less permanent basis, and expanding the council to bring in some others would widen the base of decision making. There have been efforts since then. None of them have really gone anywhere. None of them have been taken seriously enough to get traction, and I think that's a mistake. The UN, especially now when you're talking about the General Assembly and what goes on in the UN as opposed to the specialized agencies, 190-odd countries, as was noted, the truth of the matter, there's really only about 25 or 30, maybe 40 countries that matter. I'm sorry, but who?
I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, I have a real hard time with that.
But let me finish. There's a smaller group of countries that provide the overwhelming preponderance of funds, that provide the overwhelming preponderance of force when force is necessary, that provide stuff when stuff is needed, whether it's food or some other kind of material for people who are in trouble. And I, if I were trying to actually work on this, one thing I would be trying to do is coalesce with a group of leading countries, and maybe it's 20, maybe it's 40, maybe it's somewhat more than that, but a group of countries to kind of police the thing from the inside and help to deal with the problem that a lot of those 190 votes are little tiny island states who bear no real responsibility for the, or accountability for the decisions that are made or for the votes that they cast. That's the flaw in a system where every single country, if it's a country, no matter how large or small, gets a vote. You can't take that away, and again, it's a unity of a whole bunch of sovereign governments, but the management of the organization could be centered around a smaller group, an ad hoc group. It could be centered around an elected smaller group that in the way that the ILO and some of the other agencies operate with rotating members and membership that gets at things in a different way. I would also look at some of the long-lived peacekeeping operations. It's a little controversial here. Some of these, for example, Cyprus, have been in existence for 40 years. Mm-hmm. The situation on the ground is absolutely peaceful. But the presence of those peacekeepers, which cost tens of billions of dollars, I'm sure, in the case of Cyprus, gives the parties on the island of Cyprus a real good excuse not to solve the problem. And I would say the same thing exists in some of the other places where UN peacekeepers are, maybe not many, but the UN should not be, we don't really have to deal with this because somebody else is going to take care of our problem. That I think is a recipe for problems. On human rights violators, I think this is an area where the UN as an institution ought to be a little bit careful. Is it the UN's job? There are organizations or parts of the UN that have specific criteria, and that's the good and right thing. When issues become a truly compelling, the General Assembly or the Security Council may feel compelled to make a statement. But in general, I just question that, and I come back to experience I had early in the 2000s working on the problem of Darfur. Terrible, awful atrocities committed by the government of Sudan against the people of Darfur, so awful that there was a big push to call out the president of Sudan, who was overthrown a couple of days ago, for genocide. How are we going to solve the problem of Darfur? Will we solve the problem of Darfur by calling the president of Sudan a homicide or a genocidal maniac? Or will we solve it by talking to his government? And how easy will it be to talk to his government when we have labeled it genocidal? Labels can get in the way, and I particularly when it comes to the UN as a body, I at least would I think one ought to be careful in considering the effects of what one does.
And
there's two things I just want to jump in. One is the concepts, the justice concepts, nothing about us without us. And I think It's really interesting. Some of these ideas I think we should really explore. Looking at building accountability, looking at how smaller groups can help manage certain aspects of international systems this way. I think these are quite unique and quite good things to talk about. Placing it on, you know, who has the most money is going to immediately eliminate people and perpetuate a system of injustice. And I think that there could be potentially very severe repercussions to doing something in using that metric alone. So I want to put that out there, especially when you mentioned smaller islands.
I didn't identify that one alone, but
you said money and force
and other things.
Yeah, but those are two of those. But if you look at it, so we want to be very conscientious. And you mentioned smaller islands, and I look at the issue of climate change. And a few years ago, and this is Alexander especially, right? A few years ago, a number of small island developing states brought the issue of climate to the UN Security Council because they are losing their land. Their countries will no longer exist because of rising sea levels, and that is a security issue. But they don't have money or force, but the decisions that get made have a tremendous impact on them. So nothing about us without us, I think, is a nice principle that maybe doesn't move things quickly, but does move things along. But I like to discuss this idea. I like the idea of kind of an organization of management that's a smaller
conception. And I don't think we disagree. A kind of a management group needs to be diverse, and it shouldn't be cast in concrete either.
Yes.
But it should vest responsibility or a big share of the responsibility among those who are in a position to shoulder it with appropriate diversity and breadth in the community of nations.
Alexander?
It's not that I disagree with what you said, so that makes it very boring when we have a discussion if we agree, but what I wanted to point out is that if you look at how the Security Council works, there's like 5 members that are not elected, and there's 10 that are elected. And that group of 10 includes countries like whatever, Fiji or something could be in there. Anybody gets in there. Normally, most countries get... Sorry? Not loud enough? I can eat the mic. What I was told yesterday by a moderator. Okay. You'll get this deep voice now. There is already a kind of rotational system, but yes, I do agree that something that has been relatively unchanged in 75 years is up for change. It's, of course, difficult to do it, because not only that you give more power to others, it can only be done if others are willing to give up a little bit of their power. It's interesting to see that your country is taking less responsibility for the UN in the last 2 years. I think the United States should be a voice on human rights and should not leave the Human Rights Council. And if you have that role of leadership in being one of the permanent 5 members, that also gives you a responsibility to play the full role on all scales. Last thing I want to mention, and I briefly touched upon it in my very first intervention, I think with the problems that we are facing now on this planet, that I fear that many people don't realize how big the urgency is, that we basically have just 10 years to fix the problem of climate change. If we don't, we can't anymore, because you get runaway climate change. It means that there are so many effects that are strengthening each other that even if we would then stop using all fossil fuels, the climate change would only increase and increase further because of all kinds of feedback loops. The house is on fire, and we should all hands get on deck to stop this problem. And that means, of course, we need the UN, and we need NATO, and we need the EU, and we need everybody on board, but it also means all of you. It means you individually, and it means especially when you vote, that you vote for the right person, which is normally the left, I would say. But it also means your individual choices you make every day. Are you going to buy that flight ticket to Florida again when it gets cold here? Are you going to step in your car or do you step on a bicycle? Will you still eat meat? What do you do with your savings? Will you buy that extra flight ticket to Florida, or will you maybe invest it or in a rainforest? And it also means for companies. Some companies are really, really progressive on sustainability and really moving into a kind of circular economy where you try to reuse and to remake and to recycle the products that you make and already design products in a way that you know that you can use them afterwards. So you need less materials, so you have less waste. That is the kind of things that everybody can do. So if you work for a company, be active there. If you are an individual, step less in your car. If you're a student, realize, and I don't see too many students right now. Who are the students in the room here? Can I see some? Oh, I see so many. I'm so sorry. How did I overlook you? Okay, hey guys, you students, you are the new elite of this planet. You live in the most powerful country on this planet. You are at one of the best universities. You have the unique position that you are in this new generation of, let's say, the next 2 billion people that are going to be the powerful generation. Once you are there, you are out of that 2 billion. You are in the very small group of maybe 1 million that is so well educated, so well positioned, that has access to the resources to actually make a change on this planet. Be inspired by those 1.5 million students that were out in the streets 2 weeks ago to say that we are going to strike because we want to wake up the world to do something about climate change. Be innovative. If you are good in engineering, work on the solutions. If you are good in politics and talking, play a role in politics and do something good for the planet and your fellow people. If you are good in making music, make songs to make people aware of what is going on. You have the future in your hands. You are the elite of this planet, and you're so lucky to be here at this beautiful university. Thanks.
And this is actually exactly the question that I want to pose to the panel. We have about 10 minutes left, and so I'd actually like each of you, in your concluding remarks, to address a question that's been posed by several people, which is, what can we as individuals do? The people here in this room represent a pretty good cross-section of Colorado, a pretty good cross-section of America. There's business owners, there's business leaders, there's students, there's individuals, and a couple of people have asked this question of, what do we as citizens of America, citizens of countries all over the world, but as individuals do to promote the international system, to understand what it's doing, and to do our own part to help contribute to it? So I'll give you just a few seconds to think about that, and then we'll start here with Nancy and then go down. So, yes, we've got about 2 minutes each for closing remarks.
Okay, sustainable development goals. There's 17, but don't let that overwhelm you. What we have is 17 big, hairy goals, all of which will not be completely achieved by 2030. But the reason we have those is because the UN realized when we had the Millennium Development Goals in those first 15 years that amazing things happened. Poverty was reduced by half. Childhood survival and childhood health was increased tremendously. And so I would just say, take a look at those. They're a framework for thinking about how to improve the world dramatically. And in there, you'll find a goal that you care a lot about already, that before they ever came up with it. And work on that. Because what the UN said, this time, all the countries, this doesn't just apply to the developing countries who need help. This applies to every country, the U.S., Japan, Guatemala. Every country has obligations to move forward on these goals. And don't worry about working on all of them. Pick one. But know that the rest of the world, and in some very exciting ways, are working on these. And it's, where does it happen? It happens at the local level in the end. But you've got the whole world pulling with you, and they're a framework for advocacy and for doing something.
This is a is a tricky question and a fun question, and I like it. I'm glad. Thank you very much for asking. I think it's really important to continue this conversation, right? To talk here, but this conversation, most of the people in this room like what these international institutions are doing generally, but many people identified they are not. That is not the situation for everyone that they know. So why not carry the conversation forward? Go find somebody who doesn't like what international institutions do, who think you out is the way to go, and have a conversation, open, discuss further. What is it that, you know, are benefits, and what are the drawbacks? I think conversations are how we change the world. For students in particular, I have recently started advocating for students to take the Foreign Service exam. I think this is really important. What I'm seeing from other, you know, across the field, there's a gap in the U.S. State Department and people who can do things. And honestly, for all the disagreements I may and continue and will continue to have with U.S. diplomats, all due respect, I am so glad that they are there. And that helps. So whatever your political leaning, getting into that system is something that is going to have an impact in the world, and it's something that you can do. And maybe you go and do it for a little bit, or maybe you won't go and do it, but try. It's something worthwhile. And then the last thing is, I think we're pulling in a lot of ways. We're pulling these issues. We're pulling to a point that we have to, because we're dealing with massive global challenges that we have to pull everybody along to get to a solution. But that momentum of pulling soon turns to pushing, where the momentum carries on its own. It only does that if each one of us does one more thing to help. And I'm terrible at saying no, so I'm asking you not to say no. I'm asking you to do one more thing that you might do to help address these global issues in the very, very, very local level, whether it be through local government, through ensuring that your school board has good people on it who think that teaching good things about international relations is part of the curriculum. That's a school board thing. Run for the school board. To asking Amy Klobuchar, what does she think about the UN and the U.S. involvement in the UN tomorrow? Do one more thing, because you can. Just one more thing. Thanks.
Thank you, both of you, so far. Alexander named a number of things. You can vote, and as Susie said, you can weigh in with your congressmen and your senators. When you get, as I get, you know, almost daily these, take our survey, and it's, you know, candidate X or Y or Z, make sure that international affairs and American leadership is important to you. Register that. Say you want Americans, the United States, to be involved in the world, and that you want U.S. diplomacy. Because guess what? Diplomats do not have a constituency in the United States. You know, there are bases, military bases, in every single one of our states, and that's not by accident. So there's a natural constituency for the military and military spending. Diplomats don't have that. So support diplomacy. Take the Foreign Service exam. Thank you for that. Shout out. And also, think about the language. Do you like the language that's being used, the leadership that's being promoted by our administration? One thing, I'm going to read this quote, because we didn't talk about NATO, but this is the 70th anniversary of NATO. And Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, was in Washington last week. He spoke before Congress. He made many different remarks. And the thing that really hit me was, just start to speak more nicely about the alliance. That will actually improve a lot. Mm. So that's my main message. Be nice when you speak about NATO. Thank you. And that was a message to our president. So think about that across our relations.
Which reminds me that I guess I also have to be nice when I'm speaking to you, because I'd love to come back next year.
So if I said something nasty about Americans somewhere, I didn't mean it. I love you very much.
I wrote it down.
Okay. It's all written down by some diplomats now. So. There'll be a demarche in my capital tomorrow. Just to mention, I mentioned a few things, but I was thinking of while you were talking, if one thing that I would like to think about is the word equality. I think the inequality in the world is much too big, and I think the inequality within your country is way too big.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Dutchman living in Sweden, a country that is known to really work on more equality. Equality between men and women is something that gets a lot of attention now in Sweden, but also financially, a lot of support. When my daughter needed braces some time ago, there was no way that we could pay for it. It was just given for free. I mean, that's how that state works. I'm not saying you should copy that model, but I really believe I've traveled a lot in your beautiful country. I've seen extreme richness and I've seen extreme poverty. When I read that the CEO of Netflix gets a bonus of $172 million, that is absurd for a company that doesn't pay tax and on top of that gets a tax rebate. I mean, that is the kind of thing that doesn't build your country. Mm-hmm. Really not. So, whatever you can do individually or together, try to create more equality, because the people down there in poverty, it's not their fault. They can't get out of it because the system works that way. Try to change the system. Give people good education. Give them a chance. That's it. Thank you.
Again, coming last makes it easy. A lot of the important things have been said by others. I'll make 2 points. First, the institutions that we started talking about, the United Nations, but we added in the IMF, the World Bank, NATO, ILO. ILO is a different case, I guess. But a number of these organizations are institutions.
Is that someone's phone?
Whoever that
is. Wow.
That's loud.
Thank you. You can never get the damn things off when you want to. So the institutions we've been talking about are all institutions that the United States created, that have been and are important instruments of American power and influence in the world. As a practitioner, that's how I look at it. How do we use this or these organizations to accomplish things we want to accomplish in the world? And we are able, although it's always extremely difficult to get anything done in the UN system, and that's one of the reasons why people like John Bolton have some issues with how they comport themselves. Even though it's really hard, we do still get results, and I think one need not lose sight of that. On what you can do, most of the good suggestions have been made. I would add that in the aftermath of 9/11, there was a huge outpouring in America of interest in the outside, the rest of the world, and in particular in the Arab Muslim world. And after a few years, that kind of dissipated. It was an encouraging period there for a while for me, as someone involved in this stuff, to see interest rise. You're the ones that have to take up the interest, and I would encourage you to find ways, form groups through the Foreign Policy Association's Great Decisions Program is one, participation in this conference is another. There are many others. Keep yourself educated and smart on the issues before you. Encourage your school systems to have and to continue foreign language education. Mm. There is no easier way, although language is hard, there is no better way to become familiar with foreign cultures and foreign worlds and foreign attitudes than to learn another language or two, and I think it's essential for our children.
And I apologize for interrupting, but this is my first CWA, and I didn't realize quite how precise we need to be about times. I'm being told that we need to wrap up, and for the audience to please clear the room so that the next group can come in.